I think I'd rather die in a nuclear war than go to Olean.
Penn State was in the Atlantic.
You know what? The Lowell Spinners.
Good evening. This is your host, Curry Hicks Sage, the host of the UMass Basketball Podcast. I am coming to you live tonight, November 21st, about 10:55 when I'm recording this. I'm incredibly exhausted. I was planning on starting this show a great number of hours ago, and I had some life stuff, some work, and some kid, and you know how it goes. That being said, we're going to do the show. Not in the fashion that I had originally intended, but I'm hoping it'll be a good one nonetheless. Hopefully we'll keep this one to about an hour in length because I'm tired and we have a tremendous day ahead tomorrow in the lead-up to the tip-off of what could be characterized as the biggest UMass basketball game of the Matt McCall era. Saturday, noontime, Mohegan Sun. Anyway, I'm Curry Hicks Sage, coming to you live from my apartment in New York City. There is no Bennett Carroll tonight. There is no guest tonight. There was going to be a guest. I was very excited to have a guest. Life got in the way for both of us. He couldn't wait around. I couldn't wait around. He was a really good Virginia blog guy, podcast guy. He seemed like a good guy, but he only had 15 or 20 minutes. He obviously doesn't know what this show is all about if he only had 15 or 20 minutes. And then we couldn't get him on in time, and it was just a whole to-do. So it's going to be me solo. I apologize about that. I do have guests lined up for Rutgers week and for Harvard week already. So I've been thinking ahead a bit, in part because I have my second child coming any day now, and I want to try to get those banged out before the kiddo comes out of the womb. So this program, of course, is brought to you by Five College Movers. Stress-free moving in the Pioneer Valley and beyond. If you want to move, there's only one way to do so, and that's with Five College Movers. Not only are they prompt, timely, reliable, but they're big UMass fans, and that's a big part of the reason we like them. I hope to see Pat and the gang at this weekend's UMass-UVA game at Mohegan Sun. I am planning on attending. The plan here, just worked it out with my wife prior to the show. The plan is to go up Saturday, and probably come back that day. So my buddy who got a suite at Mohegan for this event doesn't yet know that, and I'm going to sort of conceal it as long as possible. Interestingly, he's not really an avid pod listener, but has been following the team very closely this year, as have a number of casuals, two of whom are coming with me, one of whom has hosted this program before, Jack Warner. J.P. Warner hosted it with me once before, big Michigan fan. He'll be coming up with me. I've converted him into being a UMass fan. And then my other buddy, my childhood and still lifelong best friend, best man at my wedding, et cetera, who is a big UMass fan but has sort of not given a shit for several years and somehow this year just loves this team. Not somehow, not surprisingly. I mean, who doesn't love this team right now? So before we get into UVA, let's talk about last night's contest, which came – actually, there are two contests since the last episode. So Central Connecticut was on Saturday. That was the first 40-plus point win for UMass since 1995, according to, I believe, color commentator and occasional play-by-play guy, Adam Frenier. Now, I was surprised to hear that because I recall a game in the – what came to mind was in the Stefan Lazmi era where we broke the century mark against LaSalle, and – I thought we would have won by 40 plus there, but maybe not. This game, I don't even remember the final. It was close to 50. I want to say like 45, 46, 90 something to 40 something. It was basically a blowout the whole way. And I know it's going to sound like a bit of a hot take. I didn't think Central Connecticut was the worst team we've played this year from a pure talent perspective. That being said, that was the most abjectly dysfunctional, completely chaotic, utterly devoid of any structure of a Division I basketball team I have ever seen. I don't know if I'm being too hard on Donyell Marshall, former UConn star. No love lost, of course, but he seems like a perfectly lovely guy. I don't know what the hell he was trying to do. I understand that they were coming back from Arizona State like 24 hours earlier, and they weren't going to look structured on the defensive end. But you'd think they'd run a few picks. I mean, they didn't set a screen. It was stunning. Just a bad display of basketball, as I likened it to on Twitter, like a group of football players playing intramural basketball at their college, at like a Division I AA school. So that was just a joke of a game. And of course, even though we played well and, you know, a lot of guys did things nicely, particularly Keon Clergeau and DeJiri Baptiste, two of the older guys on the team, getting quality minutes. Clergeau finished with 20. Baptiste had like 12 boards. I mean, he had a really good performance. That was really encouraging. What sucked, of course, was the tragic ACL tear to the great John Buggs, a backup freshman point guard who had been the third string point guard until Colton Mitchell, the other backup point guard, was injured in game one. And, you know, while Buggs had not delivered offensively, he was in many ways and remains in many ways the spirit of the roster. I mean, you just look at the kid, and I've said it before the season started. He may be my favorite UMass player on social media since Freddie Riley. For very different reasons, if we're being candid. The great Freddie Riley, of course, class of 2013. I loved Freddie more for his bluntness and candor. Buggs, I love for his enthusiasm and just zest for life. It was a real bummer to see him go down. And also, it's going to impact us. And it's been a concern of mine in terms of our lack of depth now. With Dabaji Walker still not declared eligible or ineligible by the NCAA, and with Cy Chapman still out with a mysterious personal issue, the roster is now down to 9 scholarship players, only 8 of whom see regular minutes, because CJ Jackson, who played just in just one game this year, has not factored into the regular rotation thus far. So that takes us nicely as a segue into last night's game against a pretty respectable Rider team, the Bronx. Is it the Broncos or the Bronx? Or is Bronx just short for Broncos? I don't really get it. Especially given that they're from like the Jersey Shore. So the only Bronco I can think of is like would be at like a shitty bar where it's like the Bucking Bronco. But that being said, UMass did not play terribly well in terms of a lot of the details of basketball last night. They were really bad in terms of they allowed a ton of offensive rebounds. They made mistakes, you know, just committed some careless fouls. Some guys got in foul trouble. It was a poorly officiated game, which should be noted. But they shot the shit out of the ball, particularly Carl Pierre and TJ Weeks, who combined for what I'm guessing was probably like 11 for 15 from three. I mean, TJ was like 6 for 6. It was preposterous. It was just preposterous. The fact that he only got 6 attempts was my only concern. He was just obscene. And then Carl Pierre, the captain, outstanding performance, took over in the second half, 23 points, looked like a captain. Really was great taking the ball to the rim, too. And just, you know, I mean, his friend of the show, Stu Ludicky, you should follow on Twitter, had a good point that, like, that was when you realized, like, yep, Carl's still our best player. Maybe not the most raw talent in terms of athleticism, whatever, but he's a winner. And when it came down to it, he made big shots last night. Took it from about 6 to 13 there for a stretch in the second half when Trey Mitchell was out with his fourth foul, which he picked up on a bummer of a play with about 19 minutes to go. It was very concerning for a moment there. Give DeJiri Baptiste immense credit for coming in, stepping up, and getting it done.
particularly defensively. Was weird because Ryder had that kid, their big, who had 28 points and 20 rebounds. And I know this sounds weird, but whenever there's like a random player who you're not familiar with and you don't know the names of guys on the roster and whatever, who puts up numbers like that, you never notice it. Or I didn't notice it. Maybe it's because of watching on my phone. And I was like, that kid finished with 28 and 20? Like, fuck. You know, I was just shocked. But it does indicate that we need to clean up on the boards. And it also indicates, as Coach McCall said in the post game, like, was pretty encouraging that we won by 10 against a respectable senior-laden Ryder team with, you know, some all-conference type guys, that we won by 10 while doing a lot of things pretty poorly. That said, our scoring was great, and the thing that gave me confidence last night and gave me even a tinge of optimism heading into this improbably difficult weekend at Mohegan Sun was the fact that when the game gets down the stretch, we have right now five supremely adept scoring options in the half court, not just off the press, in the half court, five supremely adept scoring options. We would have seven and become fringe top four, top five Atlantic 10 team if Sai and Dibagi both got back. That's a story for another time, and that will hurt us at some point if we don't get them back. But we have five, and particularly, and I've talked about it on the last episode, the emergence of Sean East is just such a game changer. I mean, each game he just continues to have an immense confidence with the basketball in his hands. He knows what he's doing. He is supremely self-assured. He just does the right shit. And there's something about this team that is so unlike past UMass teams, where in the half court, late in games, there's a patience, there's a poise. They're not going to wow you with their athleticism. They're just going to slowly, methodically, strategically, quietly pick you apart offensively and get a good look. And there's going to be nights where they don't go down, and that's going to be difficult. That's what happened a bit against Fairfield. They were running good offense and shots weren't falling. And shit happens. You know, they battled and they won the game. But when you have different options offensively, and when your shooters are shooting effectively, you become a really tough team to defend, no matter the opponent. Because Sean East doesn't really turn the ball over, you know, or doesn't make dumb turnovers. He's patient and calm. He can play in the pick and roll with Trey. And when Carl and TJ are lights out like that, you're now able to space the floor effectively to perfection, at least for the collegiate level. So when the offense is working, you have those two hitting threes, and you have Sean East and Trey Mitchell, and then you have Samba Diallo, who's not getting, I think, the attention he deserves. When you have him able to score both in the high post and the low post with his back to the basket, and now a little bit from deep, he's still not where he needs to be, but at least establish a bit of a three-point shot, or at least the perception that he can make that. He becomes a guy who has some space to create and operate. And that was the other concern for me in the preseason was, well, we don't have, forget the point guard thing, we've established that. The other concern was we didn't have a wing guy who could take a guy off the bounce. Well, Samba may not be a 6'4", sort of Gary, you know, well, Gary Forbes is like 6'7", but like a Gary Forbes or Dante Clark on a good night type guy. But when you have the floor space where guys have to pay a ton of attention to your two shooters and a big and a point guard, well, now Samba becomes a totally different type of offensive threat because he has space to create. And then, you know, you combine that with McCall running some really clever actions and getting guys open on little, you know, that's where I need to have some to break down sort of like what they're doing exactly in terms of particular plays. But you combine all those attributes with a guy who runs several different types of
structured sets and actions to get guys open. And if you're making shots, you can beat anybody on your schedule. And that includes the University of Virginia. So let's jump right into the University of Virginia. I wish, quite frankly, I had the guest on, and I really apologize for that in advance, because while I know a good deal about basketball, I have a kid and I have a relatively limited attention span to non-UMass basketball things, and I don't watch the NBA every night, and I can't at this point in my life methodically break down the particularities of different offense and defenses. But I can do the bare bones here. And without too much prep, let's get into Virginia. So Virginia, of course, the defending national champion, lost three players from that team to the NBA draft. So this is not the same Virginia team as last year. And the way they run defense under Tony Bennett and offense, frankly, makes it such that, I mean, I have this theory. I would love to see if one of the stat-minded people could look this up. I would love to hear it. I'm convinced that technical coaches, technically driven coaches who run complicated offenses or defenses in the Atlantic 10, most prominently, I would say St. Bonaventure with Mark Schmidt and Davidson with Bob McKillop. My theory is that offenses like that or programs like that, and UVA falls under that mantle, take a little bit longer to get their shit together. Sort of the anti-Derek Kellogg, if you will. You'll recall some Derek Kellogg teams would get out to hot starts because they had the athletes to kind of just overpower teams who were figuring their structural stuff out earlier in the year. But needless to say, so we are lucky to catch them during this particular moment. But that said, UVA, the lost, of course, from their national championship roster, Kyle Guy. They lost, man, now my brain is starting to go. My brain is really starting to go here. Let me just figure out who they lost. They lost Kyle Guy. They lost the other shooter, and they lost, oh my God, Bennett, fucking cut this. Don't cut this. I just don't look like an idiot. Who else was on that team? Ty Jerome was really good on that team, and then DeAndre Hunter. So they lost like three legit studs. Those guys would, you know, go for between 15 and 20 pretty reliably. All could, you know, Guy and Jerome could shoot the shit out of the ball. Hunter was really good. So all those guys were kind of like in the 6'3" to 6'5", 6'7" even range, but like basically wings who could defend and shoot the shit out of the ball. So they're all gone. And this is a very different Virginia team. If we're being candid, their number 7 ranking is surely somewhat a function of the fact that they were defending national champions. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily reflect truly where they are at this point in their maturation as a team coming off of a national title. That being said, they bring back some legitimate talent, highlighted, of course, by their big Mamadi Diakite. I always forget how to pronounce the kid's name. He's got that awesome bleached hair, flat top. He is really a solid player. He just does everything well. It's funny because he only averaged like 7-8 points last year, but he was really solid in the NCAA tournament, and that's obviously what, you know, most fans see most of. And now he features very prominently. But it's not the Virginia offense that anyone gives a shit about, particularly given that those three guys are gone and that they're, you know, figuring out that side of their game. It's Tony Bennett's famous pack line defense. And I was talking to some basketball heads, folks I trust in the coaching world and otherwise, like, you know, I said, basically explain the pack line defense, you know, to our listeners. And you can watch them. There's actually some really good YouTube videos on this if you really want to geek out and nerd out on this stuff. But
the deal with the pack line D is that it basically prevents any and all entries into the lane. It's impossible. It's not impossible. It's really tough to get quality paint touches, and it keeps you outside the lane. And they also do an unbelievable job. And I'd like to again see the stats here, but on limiting second chance points. So if you watched Virginia the other night against UVM, which was a really good game, and UVM almost won. The reason they almost won was because they were hitting threes. They'd get a look, and they'd let it fly, and it would go in sometimes. And if you do that, you can stay in games with them. And then if you can speed them up, right, because they're one of the slowest teams in the country pace-wise, it's extraordinary. For those of you who don't watch a ton of college basketball, I think most of us are familiar with Virginia, so maybe I'm sort of belaboring this stuff. But for those of you who don't watch stuff, it is unbelievable to look at the way Virginia defends, because sometimes you're watching it and you're like, all right, well, they're just playing hard D. Like, what's so unique about this? And then you just look at the score game after game after game. They opened the year with Syracuse, gave up 34 points. Their next game, I forget who they played, gave up 34 points. 34 points to Syracuse. I mean, I think that game was, yeah, that game was at Syracuse. Like, that's extraordinary. Then I think they played Columbia. It was like 60 to 42. They played Vermont. It was like 60 to 54, something like that. So they're not going to, like, you know, blow the roof off the gym and score 90. But they're the kind of team that could beat you, like, legitimately 58-29. And you're just like, what just happened? And it's hard to understand if you don't watch them a lot. So I've been trying to watch more tape on them in the lead up to this. And there's a reason that, of course, this style of play does lend itself periodically when they have off nights to major upsets, which is, of course, why two seasons ago they lost as a number one seed, to UMBC in one of the great college basketball games of all time, because UMBC was lights out from deep early, sped them up, and completely took Virginia out of their game. They are tempo-driven, like more than almost any team in the country. And the pack line defense, which you really should watch YouTube videos of it, because it explains basically like how they isolate teams and limit paint touches and do all these things. And it's born out of the same principles of Bennett's father, who was himself a tremendous Division I head coach. But, you know, they're not going to – I mean, they're athletic. They're strong. They're obviously an ACC team, but they're not – it's not Kentucky. It's not Duke. It's not a bunch of Zion Williamsons out there who are going to just dunk over you and just, you know, sort of freakishly overwhelm you in that regard. And given the way that UMass plays, this is a real contrast in styles, because UMass wants to speed teams up. So what we try to make teams do is very much what Virginia struggles with if we dictate tempo. Colossal if. Because this is not, Central Connecticut, right? Like, they, Kehi Clark, their point guard, is really good. He played a bunch last year. They have some secondary ball handlers who really know what they're doing. They space the floor well. These system guys who didn't even play much last year have been really good thus far. Like Braxton Key, who was like 5 points a game kind of guy last year, steps right in. You know, he's like a 6'7", really good shooter, can dribble. And they have what's the other kid with the beard? I forget his name. But they've got the pieces. So, this will not be an easy game. However, if Carl Pierre and TJ Weeks shoot the ball even like two-thirds as well as they did last night against Ryder, this will be a basketball game. And it's, again, like, even Virginia, when they win easily, it's 48-34. It's 60-42. So what's critical, I think, for UMass is to just hit some shots early. It sounds like, wow, that's a really great insight, Sage. No, but honestly, like, if you fall behind and you let Virginia dictate tempo and it's like, you know, early on and it's 12-2, the game's over. Like, you do not come back against these guys. It's their possessions are so long. You don't get second chance opportunities. When they get second chance opportunities, something we've been, is frankly been our biggest weakness this year, is giving up offensive rebounds to opponents. When they get second chance opportunities, they take advantage of them after, like, grinding you into submission for another 28 seconds. So, you know, we have to be extraordinarily purposeful with the ball. We have to run really solid sets and really, like, just be on top of our shit. There's this thing with Virginia when you watch them, and I wish I could quantify it. Maybe one of our listeners can, like, what I'm trying to explain. But there's this thing with Virginia where they just, like, there's never, like, it feels like there's never loose balls. Like, and if there are, they get them. It's just, there's this crispness to the way they play on both ends that, you know, you'll get a shot. You'll get a look. It will be contested, but you'll get a shot, but you're not going to get a second one. And it's not going to be, like, necessarily, like, an ideal look either. And you're going to have to make it. So I think to open up the floor a little, you need Pierre and Weeks shooting well. And I mean, this is, again, obvious stuff, but I think maybe there's an argument. And somebody, I think, tweeted me about it earlier, and I was thinking this already. Maybe bring Keon off the bench. Like, let's just start with two shooters on the floor. Why? Because if you go down 8-0 in the first minute and 40, it's over. It's fucking over. So, like, you don't want Keon, who can be great and can bring that energy, but you don't want him to, like, run into their defense, commit a charge, throw the ball away, and all of a sudden it's, like, you know, a 5-0 run and you're in trouble. You just have to run, like, slow and, you know, you just have to run the right stuff. I was going to say slow and steady there. Truth be told, it's like you do want to speed them up. I get the desire to do that, but if you don't speed them up, you need to have guys who make threes. Other keys to the game. Press. That worries me, of course, for day two, especially if we're going with an 8-man rotation. Like, someone I think put this in the questions. There's a part of me that's like, we could win the first game and then be so gassed on day two and so emotionally overwhelmed by that, by the outcome in against UVA, that we come out and lose to Arizona State by, like, 26. You know, like, that would be, I don't want to say a likely outcome, because I think the chances of us beating UVA are probably 15%, but it wouldn't shock me. So you got to speed them up. You got to cut down their shot clock. You got to make them, I mean, it's, that goes in with speeding them up, but you have to limit them from, taking 26 seconds and then, you know, the defense breaks down and they run, you know, a little flare screen and a guy buries a, you know, 6-footer. It's just back-breaking stuff. They just break your back. And especially for freshmen, I know how poised this team has been thus far, but we just haven't faced a test like that. You got to hit your open threes. I've already said that. And you got to get their bigs tired, because, you know, I think that if you don't do that, they're really going to, I mean, they already limit paint touches enough. They dominate you down low. But if you can't get at least a little foul trouble or fatigue them, you're in trouble. And then, of course, and this is, like, just again, any team, basically, we got to rebound the basketball. We did not do that well last night. And, I mean, I said this in the intro to the UVA stuff, but, I mean, it, you're in real trouble. They have a lot of size. You know, they have guys who can shoot who are bigs. You got to rebound the basketball. So it's going to be a battle of wills, a battle of styles. But we have the pieces to make this game interesting. It's like, I'm not going to be, I'll be able to live with myself if it's like, I don't know, because I was going to say if it was a close loss, but no, it's not about the margin necessarily, because what's going to crush my soul is if we execute really well and get the right look and it doesn't go in. Like, there have been games, it's so interesting with TJ Weeks, because he was 6-for-6 last night. Game one, he was like 6-for-8. From three, and he so lights out. And then there's been a couple games where he's been like 0-for-4 in the first half, or I'm trying to think, was it against Central? I forget who it was against. Maybe it was the Northeastern game, first half. There's been a couple instances where he's like gotten great looks and they just don't go down. And it's going to crush me if we get him the right looks and he doesn't make them. Same thing with Pierre. And it's not their fault. It's just like sometimes the ball doesn't go in. Pierre had a few in and outs last night. He finished with 23. It felt like he could have had 35. The 3 or 4 shots were like, looked dead on and just didn't go in. That shit happens. It's going to crush my soul if like we have like 10 of those from three. And like we've seen it happen, right? Or, you know, Trey, you know, gets a great look down low and, you know, goes to the line and misses free throws. Like those things, and they don't foul much, appreciate you, but it's like I'll walk out of there bummed if we like do the right shit and just can't make shots, because you're not going to beat Virginia if you can't make shots. Like that's pretty simple stuff. You're not going to like get second chances and, you know, start possessions over and throw alley-oops on them. And I mean, you might get a few of those, and I hope we do in the press, but look, I'm sure McCall watched the UMBC tape. I'm sure he watched the Vermont tape. The Vermont tape is sort of what I'm saying. Anthony Lamb, who's a fantastic player at Vermont, and had 30 against them. And 30 against UVA is legitimately like 55 against anyone else. Like, if you don't watch a lot of college basketball, and I don't watch a ton. I mean, I watch a good amount, mostly in March, but now I've been watching a bunch. If you don't watch college basketball, like, it's hard to understand just how crafty defensively Virginia is. And I know that some of the, you know, boomers on UMassHoops.com will, like, if we score 35 points, we'll think it's like a historic flop. And it's like, nope, that's just literally what Virginia does to everyone and has for a decade. So you kind of need to, now, if we gave up 80, it was like 80-35. Okay, that would be bad. But I'm just noting, like, and likewise, the 49 or whatever that Virginia scores, like, it's not like that 14-point win is really like a 40-point win, because you don't come back. So go in with the expectation that it's going to be low scoring, blah, blah, blah. If we can get to 60, we'll win. But also, like, go in with, like, you know, I guess what I'm saying is we've got to make the best of our opportunities. And there's no other way to do that than just to make buckets. That's about it. Okay. Oh, holy shit, I'm tired. All right. I really apologize for last time. Like, I am working on it. I have a recorder. I need to get a new battery for it. If anybody's sort of audio savvy, I'll bring it this weekend. So slide in the DMs, and I will happily take a quick tutorial before I hop in my car on the way home and try to make sure I don't miss the labor and delivery of my second child, who is due on December 10th. And therefore, my wife and current kid will not be joining me at Mohegan Sun, and I'll be heading back right after the basketball game. I also have some work shit that, like, I'm kind of quasi on call over the weekend, so I gotta be cognizant of that. Anyway, enough about me. Let's get to you. It is, of course, time for the mailbag. Bennett, speaking of mailbag, have we not been throwing in the, it's time for Sam the Mailman, or whatever that corny tagline I used to do was? Anyway, before I get to that, let's just once more remind the folks that this program, shoddy as it may be in technical virtue, is sponsored by folks who are incredibly detail-oriented and have no such technical issues, the fine folks of Five College Movers. Are you considering leaving the Pioneer Valley, coming to the Pioneer Valley? Really, anywhere in greater New England, they'll take care of you. Stress-free moving in the Pioneer Valley and beyond. Five College Movers, fivecollegemovers.com. Friends of UMass Athletics, friends of the UMass Basketball Podcast. And let's go to our questions tonight. First one coming in now from Tyler O'Day, a prominent denizen of UMass Twitter, one of the more followed folks on the platform. Tyler, of course, an employee of Barstool Sports, the radical left wing of Barstool Sports, as well as the virtuoso in the Christmas song album realm. He cut a Christmas album. Check that out. He says, "Are we friends?" He's often asked questions like this. "Do you love me? Are we friends?" Speaks to perhaps, and I don't want to play armchair psychologist here, but perhaps nascent insecurities, but also completely human concern. We all have those concerns. And Tyler and I would certainly qualify him as an internet friend. He and I had a tremendous train ride back from the UMass Rutgers football game this year, along with fellow UMass Twitter fixture Eric Friedlander. And I would say we were becoming friends, and we talk a lot on the internet. I don't know. I mean, if we're talking friends insofar as like he'd get, and if I were to get married today, and I've been married for 5.5 years. Would he be at the wedding? No. If we're talking someone who's back, I would get on the internet against all manner of haters. Yeah, he's a friend. I think if he were at Mohegan this weekend and I were able to stay this weekend, and you know, I would happily let him crash in the suite because we have a little extra room, I think. Although I don't know if I can ask for others because it's my buddy who's, well, he's not, I don't know if he's footing the bill. It might have been a comp deal because he's a gambler. But, you know, would I let him crash there? Yeah, if there were room, I would. He's a responsible guy, son of a politician, a good dude, really good dude. But is he a friend? Not yet. And if he was at Mohegan this weekend and I was there all weekend, I think we would maybe transcend mere internet friends and take, you know, the one night at Rutgers and turn it into a true friendship. So, Bonna Commenter, one-time guest of the program, of course, inspired by PFT Commenter, and the great PFT Commenter. Bonna Commenter, that is based on the Bonna Bandwagon site, which is that the name of their message board. It's called Bonna Bandwagon, and he's a brilliant persona. Probably, the funniest A10 Twitter account, Fight Mass, of course, up there. He says, "Is UMass too high?" Now, this, for those of you who are not constantly on UMass Twitter, those of you who we might say are not fucking losers. No, I mean, I love you, but we're all kind of losers if we're on UMass Twitter as much as we are. The stalwarts, I mean, proudly I say that. But those of you who just listen to the show and are here for the conventional basketball analysis and breakdown of recent games may not know that a popular meme among the UMass Twitter commentariat is the Fordham is too high meme. So every year during the preseason poll, you know, for the A10, it's always Fordham is 14th. And so Gaber205, great friend of the show who will be there this weekend, who I saw at the Fairfield game, had a great time with. Gaber, just one day, I think he was the first to say it. He was just like, Fordham is too high. It was really funny because, of course, they were the lowest. And now we just say it with anything that's a list. It doesn't even have to have Fordham in it. Fordham's too high. And it's funny. So he says, is UMass too high? There's two ways you could read this. One is in the realm of cannabis. Are too many people smoking pot? Are too many people, you know, high at UMass? I am aging out of that demo. I'm at 34, so I'm at the tail end of the coveted 18 to 34 demo. So we are teetering preciously close to midlife crisis territory, if you think about it, because the next demo is sort of core midlife crisis realm. But that being said, I think I still have my finger on the pulse enough. And given that weed is legal in Massachusetts, I would assume that it's ubiquitous around campus and that there's a lot of people who are high. But too high connotes a certain negativity and a problematic stonerdom that I don't think is plaguing the university. So I don't think UMass is too high in that regard. Is UMass too high when it comes to the hype of this current basketball team that is open 5-0? If that's what he's talking about, the answer is, well, ask me Saturday at about 2:20 p.m. Look, I didn't get to this in the opening, but I still have some major concerns about this basketball team, particularly given the absence of Devaji Walker and Cy Chapman, and the two point guards, because both of them were critical on the press, and you need at least one to be optimal in terms of pressing. So I have critical concerns about depth issues here, and I think that if we had one more scorer, i.e. Devaji or Cy, I would feel a shit ton better. I really hope we get at least Cy back. He's been out 5 games now, and I'm starting to get concerned. So are we too high? Well, I think our fans, yours truly included, are probably too high because we haven't yet come to the realization that if we don't get those guys back, that given the fact that we also have these injuries now, and given how good the A-10 looks thus far, we ain't there yet. But I refuse to say we're too high because, look, as I said at the outset of last episode, you know, the whole game here is about having joy. It's fun, man. Like, if you're into this shit because you somehow are chasing, you know, I don't know what you're into for. Like, look, UMass is playing good ball. There's like 50 teams out of 350 that are still undefeated. I don't care who you've beaten. And yeah, have we beaten anybody? Northeastern's decent. The other teams, not particularly. But we're 5-0. So fuck off if you're going to tell me we're too high. I'm allowed to be high. We haven't been good in a while. It's fun. Okay. Distracted Diner says, just talk shit about Thomas Jefferson for like 10 seconds and see how the guest responds. Well, there is no guest. Thomas Jefferson did sleep with his slaves and was a hypocrite in that regard. And he is, of course, I think the founder of the University of Virginia. Beautiful school, by the way. Absolutely gorgeous. But, UVA is basically the smarter man's... It's what BC wishes it was, right? It's kind of like, for better and for worse, like the real deal preppies, not the aspirational, like sort of secretly insecure, like new money BC preppies. It's like you don't always have to tell everyone you have like a fancy old summer cottage on, you know, in like the eastern shore of Maryland. You just have it. Like, so they're kind of assholes. It's basically a private school, even though it's the Commonwealth, you know, flagship campus, and it's a public school. It has a very Tony sort of posh affect. It's the sort of authentic Vineyard Vines insufferable shittiness, if that makes sense. And also a better school academically than BC. So like you have some like genuinely smart people, and because it's a public school, you have like just like some kids from like rural Virginia who are poor and really smart and like not assholes. So, I'm always curious. My theory was that the reason they struggled athletically for a while was because that intensely preppy vibe made it harder for them to like recruit. And it's like kind of that preppy vibe where like kids like go to games, but they're a little too cool for it. But that happens everywhere. So basically, I don't know if that's unique to them. But they've got it going in both football and hoops now. I mean, and in addition, of course, to like lax, ball down, dodge, lax. Yeah, all right, so what do we got? Okay, so this, so Eric Friedlander says, should TJ start since the point guard depth is shallow and run Keon and Sean separate most of the time? Yeah, I think that's the way to do it. That being said, I mean, I'm honestly going to be terrified, like fucking terrified, any second Sean East isn't on the floor in this game. Like, I would actually feel pretty confident, not confident, but like I wouldn't be completely shook if Kolton Mitchell were healthy and was a backup in this game, because he protects the basketball and Virginia, I don't think, is going to like completely overwhelm him athletically. But the fact that he's not there and that Sean East is like the only guy who, from a point guard perspective, who I feel comfortable with the ball in his hands, like I'm going to be shitting myself every time he's not in the game. Like, it's just because he can elude defenses. He's crafty. He's cagey. He can do weird things. And when he's in there, like that will allow him to like run some little pick and pop with Trey and get Trey an open look. And, you know, it will allow guys to have to sort of back off of our shooters a little, or respect our shooters a little, because they're just, you know, have to be aware that Sean might come into the lane. And like Keon, you know, I think he's fine as a backup against even a lot of the Atlantic 10 at the one. But like, you know, the ball's got to move against Virginia. And, you know, I just don't see it happening if Sean East is not on the floor. So I do want to start those two shooters because I want to just get out to a little bit of a lead and put some pressure on them. And then I also think, then you throw Keon in as the energy guy, right? So now, like, you got Virginia like sort of second guessing themselves, and Keon comes in and he's just a fucking maniac. And that actually is a, you know, 1-2 punch that, like, if I'm, and I'm thinking a little bit of this out loud, like, but I think if I'm coaching this game, I try to run a couple actions right off the bat for Pierre and TJ, and I try to take a quick lead, maybe a 3-4 possessions in a row kind of deal. Maybe Trey takes 1-2, maybe Sean East kind of runs down the lane and you get a little alley-oop or whatever. But, you know, then the second there's like a stoppage in play, or, you know, even, you know, a TV timeout, if you have a little lead, then you throw in Keon to be a maniac, and it kind of throws UVA off a little, and it maybe gets you something in the press. And then, you know, you go from there. But yeah, I agree with you. I think that is right. And how do you keep TJ Weeks out when he's shooting that well? I mean, I know he was plagued by foul trouble last night, but I mean, the kid, it's like you watch him shoot and you're like, I'm watching like Steph Curry in his prime. Like it's downright savant shit, as I said on Twitter last night. Riff Raff Street Pat, PVL7. How much are you adjusting expectations for the season after this great start, but headed into the tough part of the schedule? And how much does it depend on getting Sai Dabaji on the court? Yeah, so I've alluded to the latter part of that question a bit already in the show. But I would say that if you recall my preview episode, I think what I said was, look, you hope for 4-1 and or you hope for 5-0. And if you want to be like 500, you kind of got to win at least minimum 4. And so we took care of business. And I think the Fairfield win on the road, as modest in margin as it was actually quite significant, because it was a win on the road. And that's something that McCall has struggled to do in his first 2 and change seasons here. So I thought that was actually a kind of a character building win, and there have been a lot of like character building wins thus far. You know, like we didn't play great last night, but we figured it out. So, you know, Northeastern was a solid team, and we took their best shot. The Fairfield went on the road, and even Lowell, like the way we closed them out was encouraging. So I've seen a lot. It's not just the results, but it's kind of, and the emergence of Sean East has like obviously changed my outlook on the team, because I just didn't see him being what he's become. And each game, it's like more and more impressive. Even last night, he finished with 8 assists, but there was like 2 or 3 plays where he threw low-key, like, epic baseball passes that resulted in foul shots that, like, could have put him in a double-double with 10 and 10. Guy's got one of the best assist-to-turnover ratios in the country. He's a freshman. And, like, he's fantastic. So that's been the greatest source of light. That and the fact that TJ has been an even better shooter than I think. Like, everybody's like, oh, he's Carl-Pierre Chipunone, he can shoot it. But you're like, all right, well, like, cool. I guess he'll hit 2 or 3 threes. Dude went 6 for 6 last night from 3. Like, that's insane. So I'm feeling better, and I'm feeling like they're able to spread the floor. That said, the loss of those 2 point guards does hurt them on the press, and it presses very possibly CJ Jackson into action, even if he's maybe not totally ready to go yet. We're going to learn quickly, I suspect, although they didn't play him last night, so who knows. But so, in other words, like, had we had no injuries, I think that and this goes to the second part of your question too, had we had no injuries, I think like the Cy Dibaji piece would be maybe a little less concerning, because we could at least just throw waves of bodies out there and play 10 guys and make it harder on teams. Now, you know, it kind of forces you a little bit without those 2 point guards often at the top of the press, you know, in that sort of diamond press deal, playing interesting roles there. Like, it does concern me, and kind of takes me back a little to like preseason expectations. Being said, if you get Cy and Dibaji back, I think you can still compete for like top 6, top 7 in the A-10. But look, and I probably should have reiterated this earlier in the show. People need to understand right now that this is a very young basketball team. And no, I'm not making excuses and all that, blah, blah, blah. But the next, not only is it a very young basketball team, not only is it a team without, I think, one of the maybe the most interesting all-around offensive option from a versatility perspective in Dibaji Walker, and perhaps the most physically gifted guy on the roster in Cy Chatman, who I thought was going to have a real breakout year and be a double figures guy. Not only are you without them right now, but this next stretch of 1, 2, 3, 4, I think it's basically 6 games straight, is as challenging of a 6-game stretch in the non-conference as I can remember seeing in the post-Bruiser era. Bruiser had a couple of those years, his first couple seasons, that were just ruthless. But certainly, I think and Lapis played some decent schedules, but certainly in the last 15 years and since Travis Ford came in 05, 06, we've not seen anything, I don't even think, comparable to this. I mean, defending national champs, then Arizona State or St. John's, both pretty quality this year. Arizona State, both in the tournament last year, if I'm not mistaken. Then you have a little time off and you go at Rutgers, who's a Big Ten team that many people think could compete for a tournament bid this year. Yes, they lost to St. Bonaventure, but they're still legit, and Bonnie needed that win. I've told some people, bet the shit out of that game because Bonnie's going to win on the money line, and they did. Even though they were 0-3 and Rutgers was 3-0 entering, but it was like Rutgers had 3 kind of narrow wins, Bonnie had 3 narrow losses, and I was like, you know, Mark Schmidt in Toronto with all those Bonnie fans, like, not going to lose this game. But, you know, Rutgers is still legit. Then you come back home a few days later and you play South Carolina. I know they're not the same South Carolina team as they've been, you know, 3 years ago when they're in the NCAA tournament, but Frank Martin's still a hell of a coach. Frank Martin already lost to BU, which maybe makes people think like, oh, they're eminently beatable. To me, weirdly, games like that always make me fucking terrified, because you're like, well, they've already had the bad loss, so now they're going to just fucking be really motivated and not take another mid-major from Massachusetts lightly. And then 3 days after that, you go at Harvard, who many have considered a fringe top 25 team now. And then you come home and play Yale, who was in the tournament last year. So maybe I'm a little bit over-exaggerating it, because Yale is definitely not the same team as they were a year ago. Harvard is dealing with some big time injuries, although I think Bryce Aiken will be back by the time we play them. He's been on that team for, if I'm not mistaken, 26 seasons in a row now and torched us like 31 times total. And, you know, Towns, I know, is still out with injury. But, you know, there, if Aiken's back, like, yes, it's de facto home game for us because it's a UMass Twitter takeover at Lafitte's Pavilion in Cambridge. But, and so there is something exciting about that. But, like, look, these next six games are really tough. Now, I do think, so I guess this answers the first part of your question. I do think now, when you consider that, I mean, Rutgers at Rutgers, that's probably a loss because it's at Rutgers. We got to figure, you got to remember how hard the road is, although I don't consider Harvard a road game. But Harvard, given their injury situation, if one of those guys is still out, Yale at home and South Carolina at home, given that they've lost to BU, all three of those are winnable, perhaps more so than I realized in the offseason. So you could make a case that you should win two of the next six.
And you can make a case that you can win four. Should win two, capable of winning four. Realistically, you should win one, compete in three, and hopefully steal one of those so you should get two. So I would be perfectly delighted if you 7-4 entering the main game at the moment.
They lost to Vermont at home, so like that's another winnable game if you lose to Virginia and they lose to Arizona State. So like I would be thrilled if they could go 3-3. I would be ecstatic and, you know, teetering on orgasmic if they could go 4-2. You know, but if they go 2-4, I'd be very content. 1-5, modestly disappointed. 0-6, if there were a bunch of close losses, I wouldn't lose my shit over it, but I'd be like, well, this is kind of what we were expecting. So I'm not adjusting my expectations a ton, but I'd be lying if I said that I didn't think a few of these next six were more winnable than I did even 2 weeks ago. So Sitchman, great friend of the show, he'll be at Mohegan, I believe. Riff Raff, Street Pat, and Distracted Diner will be there as well. So this is a big UMass Twitter crew. We got to figure out something, because I know I'm only going to be there briefly, but we should figure out like a halftime spot or something. I would love to say hello to everyone. So Sitch says, you're on the team now. Pick your roommate, BFF, mentor, drilling/one-on-one partner, road trip guy. Oh, wow. That's a fantastic question. Whew. Okay, my roommate. So I would also, by the way, I would think my road trip guy, if he's, when he says road trip guy, I presume he means your roommate on the road. And that raises an interesting question right off the bat. Do you want the same roommate when you're on campus as when you're off it? And that's a purely temperamental question. If you are someone who has a very kind of, if you're very much one who thrives on routine, then I think you're the kind of person that needs the same guy. Me, I like to mix it up. I like novelty a bit, maybe a bit too much. I like, you know. So I would think I'd actually maybe even, and I know it might be a cop-out, but I might even mix it up on my road trips. Like, I'm not a super crazy superstitious guy, so like I don't need it to be the same guy, but if I had to, gun in my head, pick one guy like for road trips, because there's not that many of them, and maybe you want to figure out that flow a little. So I'm going in reverse order here, but road trip guy. Well, it's tricky, right? Because it's a great question. Because what are you looking for in a road trip roommate? You want it to be a business trip, and all those dumb cliches they say in sports, like, you know, it's a business trip. You know, we're out here on business. It's like, okay, you're like 19 and like you don't know what a business trip is, but cool. And they're not always that fun. I guess that is what they're saying. It's not always that fun. It's a business trip. But you know what I'm saying? It can be fun. So I'd want someone who could like, I'd be loose with, but like I'm not going to be tempted by. I'm not going to like, so I could like laugh and like fuck around with, but I'm not going to, like, you know, be tempted to go and party with the night before a game because of their effective peer pressure. So who's someone, like, who's a good conversationalist you can talk to, but, like, when it's time to go lights out, like, lights out? I think in that instance, I'm probably going with Samba. He's kind of funny. He's a little bit mysterious, but, like, he's ultimately, like, responsible, mature, and, like, you'll get to sleep and you're not going to, like, you know, worry about, like, missing breakfast the next day. And he'll probably wake you up. Like, I am not particularly a morning person, so he would, I feel like, reliably, like, he would wake me up, you know, before, like, if we had to get to a team meeting. Like, you're not going to miss the shoot around if you're Samba's road roommate. So then the next question, so the second part of the question is your roommate, like, at home. And that's a much bigger question. That's, like, straight up, who do you rock with? Who do you vibe with just on a temperament level? And for me, on this team right now, like, who is, like, my homie? I think, see, like, I'd be tempted, the temptation, the easy answer, the cop-out answer is, like, Carl Pierre, because he's, like, the captain, he's responsible, but he's still, like, he's, like, very much not a loser, he's still cool and, like, you know, sociable. But I almost think that, like, that's a lot, I'd be, like, I'd have anxiety, and I'd be, like, yeah, well, Carl, like, he always, like, does the little things well, and, like, I didn't even, like, do the reading for that class and fuck, you know, like, I'd be doing all those, like, kind of ruminating in my head. So I don't think that I really want to be around someone who's sort of like that together with their shit. And certainly when I was 21, I wasn't that together. So I think I want someone who's, like, you know, really cool, like, but, like, a little flawed maybe, but, like, working on it and just, like, living their best life and, like, self-aware and good dude. I think that person on this team is probably Sean East. Who am I fucking kidding? I absolutely want Sean East as my roommate. He's funny. He loves hoops. He's not going to get in trouble, but he'll still fuck around and party if you want once in a while. And, like, you can, he seems like an open dude. You can talk to him about whatever. He's my roommate, 100%. And he's my BFF. Same guy. I mean, your roommate and your BFF should be largely interchangeable. My mentor, I mean, I'm 34 years old and I remain completely convinced that Dejiri Baptiste, who speaks like 17 languages and, like, already has a degree from Vanderbilt, like, is basically more, like, he could be, like, my dad. So he's definitely something of a mentor. He could teach me quite a bit. Carl Pierre could, too. Yeah. I mean, but you also want a mentor who's a little bit more, maybe shares, like, your affect, but is, like, a little bit more of a mature version. And, like, weirdly, even though he's a freshman, like, that, you can make a case that that's, like, TJ Weeks, because he's got, like, an even-keeledness that is unusual for a kid that age. He's just, like, he's like, yeah, like, I'm out here, like, kind of chilling. Like, I'm going to hit, like, six threes and, like, I'm not even going to make a big deal about it. Like, I'm just kind of a chill dude. I'm going to go back and, like, do my thing. Like, that's something you kind of, like, want to learn how to be like. And then my drilling one-on-one partner, like, for me, I need to improve my strength and, like, gain a little weight. So, like, I might say Keon, because, like, Keon's just gonna be like, if you're not doing your shit, he's gonna be like, what the fuck? Like, what the fuck? Do your shit. And he's just, like, not gonna take, like, any, like, yeah, like, you know, other guys on the team are probably a little more forgiving. I don't feel like that's his vibe, so you kind of need that sometimes in a workout partner. Great questions. UMass man says, when we beat UVA on Saturday, who will lead us in scoring? I think almost undoubtedly, well, I was going to say almost undoubtedly one of the two shooters, but I think maybe Trey Mitchell, because he's overdue for a big game, and I think he has the ACC athleticism and just skill to kind of, if he stays out of foul trouble, to just like step back, hit some big time threes. And remember, our leading scorer could be like 13 points. So I think I'm going to say Trey. That might be it, because everybody else I asked for, oh no, the real G Warner, not to be confused with JP Warner, who's coming to the game with me, says, how is McCall going to let it get his guys to value the ball in a low possession game where each wasted possession makes it closer to impossible to win? So, like, I don't know how a coach can impress upon his kids that, other than to show them a lot of tape. But I think this team does have a unique ability to internalize scouting reports effectively. I think there's so much tape on Virginia, and they run, you know, roughly similar stuff as they have for years, that, like, I'm not, he's going to convey it properly. It's just like, until you've seen it, you know, I mean, like, again, it's like one of those things where it's like, how can it be so difficult? We've all seen it a million times, and yet it's like, it is. It just, that's what it is. Like, there's a reason they do this to everyone. You know what I mean? And if you catch them the right night, like, maybe you transcend that. But I don't think the guys are going to come out, like, careless. They might look careless because Virginia makes them look careless, but I don't think it's going to be like guys dribbling off their shoe and shit. Like, you know what I mean? I don't get that vibe. I think they'll be, they understand, I don't want to say the magnitude of this game, because, like, no one's expecting us to win, but I think these kids understand the opportunity in front of them. And I think they understand on some level that, yeah, they're 5-0. Yeah, they've generated a bunch of buzz, but you go 5-0 to 6-0 against Virginia, and that kind of superficial buzz becomes national. And that's what's so great about playing a defending national champ in a casino at a neutral site on TV when you've started 5-0, is that you've kind of done the prerequisite work of, like, such that if you get a win, now it's like, well, it's not like they just beat UVA after starting 1-4. Maybe this UMass team is for real. And I think that's what's so exciting here. I think the kids understand that. Like, it's not a huge game in the sense of, like, oh, they have to win. It's a huge game in the sense that overnight you can transform the perception of your entire program. Overnight you can put yourself back on the map. Maybe in the short term, maybe temporarily, given everything else that's going to come after that. But you have an opportunity to, A, say, well, the first five games weren't a fluke. And B, be like, just fucking get the top headline on ESPN for an hour. You know what I mean? Like, it's one of those type of things. And it's monumental just for, I think, the Western Mass fan base, who always keeps this program at like this fascinating arm's length, where they know what's going on, they follow the score, but they're not rushing to the Mullen Center until given a real tangible reason. Yeah, you're going to see a modest uptick after a win over a 13th seeded Northeastern team from a year ago that lost by 30 to Kansas and brought back, you know, didn't even bring back a lot of the stars. Like, yeah, some diehard college hoop heads are going to be like, oh, they weren't there in the tournament? Cool, I'll check them out. But you beat the defending national champs, and all of a sudden, all kinds of people are telling you they've been at UMass games for years. Oh, yeah, yeah, I'm a big UMass. Like, that's when they start coming out of the woodwork. So there's a massive opportunity there to engage a whole host of people who are, you know, very casually invested right now. And that's what's so exciting about the game. Now, I had a bunch of questions earlier in the show, because I was going to have a guest on. And so I'm going to try to find a couple of those, where one person asked, O'Brien1219 says, would a W versus the Who's, and I don't know why they're the Who's. It's like some, is it a Dr. Seuss thing? I forget. I mean, they're the Cavaliers, but whatever. Followed by a loss to ASU/St. John's, be UMassie? 100%. Incredibly UMassie. That being said, I think it's hard for this team to be, okay, let's just be clear for those who are newer listeners to the show. When we say UMassie, we're talking about UMass teams in the past who just do like unfathomably unpredictable shit to the point of predictability. Like their unpredictability becomes predictable because it's just like classic UMassie, and that would be like beating a great team and then losing to a shitty one. The difference here is A, this team is too young to like really be UMassie, because to be UMassie you have to like genuinely disappoint and have like given us hope of expectations early. This team is still so young that it's like anyone who's being realistic can't be expecting like insane shit thus far or this early. But it would be incredibly UMassie to beat the defending national champs and then lose to like St. John's by like 13. I mean that, and yet I wouldn't really be terribly upset because like we're still young. So like a 13-point loss to one of the teams isn't like out of the norm of like our talent level and experience level. So that I guess if that makes sense, like it might be more UMassie to like win this tournament, beat Rutgers on the road, beat like Harvard on the road, be like 10-0 and ranked like 16th in the country, and like sell out the Mullen Center for fucking, or beat South Carolina, sell out the Mullen Center for fucking Maine, and like lose by 6. Like that's the, and then like lose to Akron and enter conference play like 11-2 with everyone being like, maybe they're not so good after all. Like that's kind of the consummate UMassie. I mean, it's obviously a little hyperbolic, like, but you get the idea. So, Matt Broderick, not my day off. He said, that's his handle. How do you think UVA will handle the full court press? I mean, I think they'll handle it fine. They'll probably largely break it, but my hope is that it will just speed them up enough and they'll be young enough that like it will throw them off on enough possessions such that we can get runouts and open looks. Like I see it as, my hope is that it will lead to just enough possessions on the other end that where we can play 5-on-4 or 4-on-3 or whatever, and that give us a chance to keep this game close. Jake Barnes, who I believe is the head of the militia, says, any chance we draw back into the zone at the half court after the press with concerns matching up? It's a great question. I haven't given a lot of thought to that. UVA has size, but they also have shooters, so it's a little bit of a pick your poison. I wouldn't be surprised if we flash a little bit of zone, but I don't expect to see a ton of it. Yeah, that's like, I thought somebody asked me about like DeGiri getting more minutes. I don't know. Oh yeah, here we go. Stu Ludicky. Go Trey at the 4 and DeGiri at the 5 for much of the game so that we can avoid getting absolutely hammered on the glass while still being able to open things up on offense. Yeah, like I'm not opposed to that at all, especially given their size. I think they have a 7-footer. And then the Nikite or whatever his name is like 6'8", 6'9". Trey will be okay with him. I mean, it's not ideal, but I think, yeah, it's not a bad call to go with those two. But then the question is like, all right, if you go with those two, I guess what going with those two means that Samba loses minutes, which isn't maybe a terrible thing against Virginia, just because Virginia's an ACC-type team that's very, with a lot of like six-set, like Braxton Key is a kid who could guard Samba with, you know, pretty easily. Like, so yeah, it might actually make sense to take a few minutes from Samba and keep the two bigs in, the two shooters, and Sean East. Like, that might be what you're riding with here. I think that's a good call. Yeah, somebody else asked that. Mount Tom 22, could we see them on the court together? I think it's a good flag by people, and I think that's actually very much something that could happen. All right.
I think that's about it for tonight. I hope you enjoyed it. I think this actually ended up being a better episode than I was expecting. I really hope the audio turned out all right. As the former co-host Andrew Kalagi, a.k.a. A. Kalagi for longtime listeners, would say, we love you. We out. Hit me up if you're at Mohegan. Slide in the DMs. Curry Hicks Sage on Twitter. Spread the word about the show. Like and share the show. And thanks again to Five College Movers and everybody for listening. See you next week.